Not since I woke up, Jason said. Was she looking for me for something?
No, Belinda said. Just do me a favour and don't be too... you when you see her.
To me?
Yes, Belinda said. You know what I'm talking about.
I don't think he can help it, Clive said.
Don't believe it, Belinda said. He might seem all over the place, but it's a lot more deliberate than you think. I know a flim-flam man when I see one.
Jason flashed her a grin and went inside the house. The team looked at the dark hole leading into the earthen bank. It was hard to think of it as a burrow when they could have driven the skimmer into it with room to spare. Henrietta frowned at the dark opening, one of many they had spotted nearby.
This one is dangerous, she said. Dark hunters, bronze rank. They appear in large numbers and like to dig themselves a warren of dark tunnels.
I'll go, Jason said.
I don't think going in there alone is a good idea, Henrietta said.
Going with someone else would be more dangerous, Jason said. This is my kind of fight. A fight in the dark against powerful monsters was exactly what he needed to push his perception power over the edge. Humphrey and Clive, with their human advantage, had already reached bronze rank with their perception powers, gaining enhanced aura senses. Neil, who had been an essence user longer than Jason, had likewise reached bronze with his perception power. It gave him the ability to sense vulnerabilities in magical defences and detect injuries, both in allies and enemies.
I'm not sure going into the dark all alone is a good strategy.
Going alone into the dark is my best strategy, Jason said. I've been practicing fighting in various ways this trip. Now it's time to fight my way. Henrietta looked at Jason. The usual whimsy was absent from his expression. All that was there was confidence and determination.
Very well, she conceded. I don't want you to hesitate to call on us if it goes wrong, though. We've come close enough to losing you already.
Jason walked forward, his cloak manifesting around him. As he went into the tunnels, stars on his cloak floated into the air, turning pure darkness into dancing shadows. The rest of the team waited, with no indications of anything coming from the cave.
Asano, are you all right?
Henrietta asked after a while. Yes, Jason's voice came back. It's about to begin. She concentrated on the hole in front of her, extending her aura senses.
What is it?
Humphrey asked, seeing her focused gaze.
Your aura senses are stronger now, Henrietta told him. Push them forward, into the caves.
You said dark hunters were good at concealing their auras, Humphrey said.
They are, Henrietta said.
Humphrey did as he was told, concentrating his senses on the burrow entrance in front. Sophie and Clive did the same, using their own enhanced aura senses. It was hard to sense anything from within the warren, but they picked out an aura radiating fear and panic. It was coming closer, towards the burrow entrance directly in front of them. A creature came stumbling out of the hole. It looked like a praying mantis the size of a Saint Bernard, but with the stinger tail and hard black exterior of a scorpion. It had lost a leg somewhere and was leaking dark fluids from beneath chitinous plates. From the darkness behind it came a cold voice.
Mine is the judgment, and the judgment is death.
Light shone down on the monster from nowhere, a glorious mix of silver, blue, and gold. The beauty of it was belied by the effects of the transcendent energy that rapidly evaporated the monster into rainbow smoke. Jason didn't emerge from the hole. Only the team members with bronze rank aura sensors caught a glimpse of his aura in the moment the spell was cast. They spotted more monsters emerging from the other holes around them, evacuating their underground warren. The creatures ignored the adventurers as they skittered away as fast as their legs would carry them. Each radiated an aura steeped in the same fear and panic as the first.
That's odd, Henrietta said, frowning at the fleeing monsters.
What is? Humphrey asked.
They're called dark hunters for a reason, Henrietta said. I've never heard of them escaping into sunlight before.
Some of the monsters were faster than others, who were clearly impaired. The most damaged started dropping dead shortly after making the surface, while the others grew more and more sluggish over time until they too collapsed to the ground.
Jason's exit from the Warren was presaged by floating lights that returned to their place on his cloak as he emerged into the light. He started making his way around the dead monsters, using his blood harvest power on all the bodies before looting them. He didn't need to refresh his mana anymore after the first couple of monsters, but kept doing it to level his ability. Finally completing his rounds, he returned to the group as if he'd been out for a stroll, nodding at the skimmer. "Shall we?" It finally happened as Jason meditated on the roof of the cloud house that night. It began with a burning sensation behind the eyes, which became a sharp, twisting pain until it suddenly stopped. Ability, Midnight Eyes, Dark, has reached Iron 9, 100%. Ability, Midnight Eyes, Dark, has reached Bronze 0, 00%. Ability, Midnight Eyes, Dark, has gained a new effect. Ability, Midnight Eyes, Dark. Special ability, Perception. Base cost, none. Cooldown, none. Current rank, Bronze 0, 00%. Effect, Iron. See through darkness. Effect, Bronze. Sense magic. Ability, Midnight Eyes, Dark, cannot advance further until all attributes have reached bronze rank. Jason's vision swam, and he was struck with potent vertigo. He rolled forward from his meditative pose, onto all fours for stability. The world felt like it was tipping and turning around him. Jason's senses were filled with strange new stimuli. He could smell something strange on the air, carrying a faint ozone tang like the aftertaste of a spirit coin. He could feel his necklace and amulet like electricity against his skin, but not at all painful. He took it out of his shirt, and it visibly shimmered with power. The much weaker magic woven into his everyday clothes was milder, but still visible. He pushed himself back into a sitting position as the dizziness became manageable. Around him, even the ambient magic in the air had become perceptible. It wasn't just his sight, either. He could feel the magic like a breeze on his skin, smell and taste it in the air. Actual magic objects like his amulet and boots had what looked like a shimmering heat mirage on them. He conjured his cloak and dagger, and was able to see the mana emerge from his body like a blue mist before coalescing into the conjured objects. They were similar to his magical items under his new senses, but still noticeably different. The cloud house underneath him was a vast well of magic, although his perception couldn't penetrate beyond the exterior. He carefully pushed himself up on his feet, still a little unsteady. His vision was swimming, like he was looking at the world through a fishbowl. He stood in place and focused on regaining his equilibrium. Eventually, his sense of balance settled, his eyesight got under control, and he took stock of just how differently he was perceiving the world. He could sense subtle shifts in the ambient magic around him, but it was all too new to make any sense out of it. He would need time to become acclimatized to all the new sensory input. Once he was sure of his balance, he made his way to the edge of the roof. The cloud house was once again in the form of a two-story building of desert stone, the rooftop giving him a broad view of the desert vista. He dropped lightly off the side, his cloak allowing him to drift gently down. He could feel the conjured object like it was part of him, as he fed it the extra mana to reduce his weight. His new senses, however, suggested it was not his weight that was being changed, as he sensed it affect not him, but a field around him. It explained how he was able to share the cloak's power with others, and he wondered if the actual functionality was to somehow affect gravity. He alighted on the ground next to Sophie, who was just coming out of the building. "Are you all right?" she asked. "I could sense your aura up on the roof, and it was all over the place. You aren't normally that sloppy." "I finally had that bronze breakthrough," he said. "Probably not a big deal for the person who got their first power to bronze years ago. So, are you talking to me again now? Counting when I was unconscious, this is the first thing you've said to me in a week." She shifted her gaze, not meeting his eyes. It was a stark contrast from her normal mode of glaring at the world like it owed her money. "It's kind of obvious that you're giving someone the silent treatment when you're riding around the desert together in a half-broken-down skimmer," he said. "I'm not avoiding you," she denied. "That might have sounded more plausible if you weren't avoiding eye contact right in front of me when you said it." She lifted her head to stare defiantly at him, but he spotted the vulnerability behind her eyes. He gave her his best reassuring smile.
How about you tell me what the issue is, and we'll see what we can do? She frowned hesitantly, and he watched her body language draw back.
They told you that you were almost fed a potion that would have killed you, right?
She asked, voice muted and reluctant.
It rings a bell, Jason said. I'd just come out of a 4-day healing coma, so my retention rate wasn't ideal.
They didn't tell you it was me, though, did they?
She asked.
I was the one who rushed ahead. If your voice chat wasn't still up, if Neil hadn't realized what I was doing and called out for me to stop.
Jason blinked a couple of times, then let out a chuckle.
I almost killed you, and you think it's funny?
It is now, Jason said. If you'd actually killed me, I imagine I'd view it differently. You rushed to my side, you say?
Rushed might be a strong word, she backpedaled. I suppose you could call it a brisk pace.
He grinned and laughed again. I think some humanity is starting to show under that stony facade, Wexler.
Celestinity? Is that a word?
Look, I'll take a reckless desire to help over cold indifference any day. Well, not any day. I can think of some scenarios where...
It doesn't matter.
The point is, I'm glad you rushed to save me. Yes, it didn't go as planned, but you learn for next time. Instead of taking a potion, pick up Neil and carry him.
What was that? Neil's voice came from inside. He wandered out of the building to join the pair.
Nothing, Neil, Jason called back. We're just discussing strategies to render healing assistance when someone has already taken a potion.
Oh, all right, Neil said, then clearly realized what must have prompted the situation as an awkward expression crossed his face.
You can go, Neil, Jason said.
Thank you, Neil said quickly and ducked back inside.
Oh, Neil? Jason called out after him.
Yeah? Neil's voice drifted back out.
Is there any chance you could stitch handles into your clothes?
Handles? Sophie stifled a snort of laughter.
Yeah, Jason said.
One somewhere on the upper torso, maybe under one arm, and the other on the thigh. That should be a good balance.
Asano, Neil said. I have no idea what you're up to, but the answer is no.
Probably for the best, Jason confided quietly in Sophie. I think some kind of rucksack situation would be better. You'll be able to run faster with him slung over your back. One of those child carrier backpacks, but sized for a super ripped elf.
No, you don't want to carry that lot around.
Do you have Oki straps here?
Never mind. Belinda can probably knock some out with that power she has for creating regular items.
Do you know where she is?
All right, seriously, Neil said, coming back outside.
What are you two talking about?
We're trying to find Belinda, Jason said innocently.
You haven't seen her, have you?
Chapter 16. Disbanded. The criminal culture in Greenstone was in a state of extreme flux. The Builder Cult Purge had turned over every rock in Old City, exposing many criminal enterprises. That the cult had attached themselves to many such clandestine operations only made things worse. Old City's criminal leadership thrived on being ignored by the island, but now the powerful island factions had placed their attention aggressively on Old City. For the crime lords known as the Big Three, the purge had brought about very different results. Adrus Dorgan was on the rise in the wake of his daughter being revealed as director of the Adventure Society. When she came through the subsequent inquiry still holding her position, Dorgan's place in the city hierarchy was solidified. He gained a powerful shield against pressure from the ruling elite. There were also rumours that he was heavily involved in the more secretive elements of investigating the Builder cult's activities, obtaining powerful concessions for his trouble. Whatever the truth, his operations had somehow come out of the purge stronger than before. Clarissa Ventress had been extremely quiet, even before the purge. In the summer, she had been pushing into Cole Silver's territory, trying to snatch away as much of it as she could. The goal had been to capitalize on the chaos following the old patriarch's death, but Ventress had suddenly halted all such efforts overnight. Rumors abounded as to the reason, but Ventress and her organization quietly managed their existing affairs, until just over a week ago, when word spread that Ventress was dead.
The circumstances of her demise were being closely contained by her people, with her former bodyguard, the Leonid Darnell, stepping into her position. The change in leadership seemed to have been completed without too much contention, but the air of uncertainty remained, becoming a pall dangling over their operations. Despite the relatively smooth transition, Darnell's power was extremely unstable, especially coming in the wake of the Purge. The unease spread through his territory and his people, making them vulnerable to outside forces. Oddly, Andras Dorgan had made no move to exploit this weakness and expand, despite his own solid position. Instead, it was Cole Silver who seized the opportunity. Silver had experienced similar problems after seizing the reins his father had left behind and was still in the process of consolidating power. Many in his own organization were unhappy with the changes he was making to how they operated, and much of the old leadership were in the extended process of being pushed out. The Purge had hit Silver's operations hard. Cole had finally brought things under control by making sweeping changes. The old guard were excised and new avenues of operation were established. Unlike his father, Cole had pursued his ambitions with no concern for whom he worked with or what they worked on. Interests his father had always avoided were suddenly on the table, bringing in new sources of revenue and control. The lucrative nature of the new operations was the factor that allowed him to finally unite the organization fully behind him. Silver's lax approach to choosing partners to operate with allowed a number of builder cult operations to embed themselves within his organization. As a result, many of his rackets had been scoured by forces of the Duke, the Adventure Society, and even a coalition of noble families spearheaded by the Mercers. Despite this, Silver was taking the chance to grab as much of the territory Clarissa Ventress once controlled as he could. It left him juggling a lot of balls at once, and a personal project had been put aside. He had been willing to let one of those projects hibernate as the object of his attentions had left the city for an extended period. Now Silver had information that Asano was due to return, and he was taking time from his territorial ambitions to set new events into motion. Silver left his office in the fortress, gesturing at his bronze ranker bodyguard to follow. Silver himself was a bronze ranker, but he had nothing in the way of combat skills. His taste in violence was to enact it upon those too powerless to fight back. He had raised his rank purely through the consumption of monster cores. His bodyguard was one of five other bronze rankers currently in his employ, the most powerful and valuable members of his organization. The fortress was neutral ground for the big three, each controlling their own sections. Silver made his way to an elevating platform that only he and his most trusted men could access. They descended into the bowels of the building, deep into the underground vaults built centuries ago to shield the citizens at the time from monsters. Killian Laurent was waiting for him in a luxurious subterranean lounge Silver used for his most clandestine meetings. His father had the room set out in subdued decor, but Silver had redecorated, marking the organization's most private sanctum as his own. On the walls, wood paneling had been painted black, while the thick new carpet was a brazen red. The simple and elegant furniture his father had favored was replaced with plush satin chairs and lounges. The simple recessed glowstone in the ceiling had been replaced with a resplendent chandelier. In place of the restrained old artworks that had adorned the walls were bold images of sex, violence, and power.
"Mr. Silver,"
Laurent greeted. The pallid elf got up from where he had been perched, on the edge of a chair, waiting.
"If you are ready, I will bring our first guest."
"Why wasn't he already waiting here?"
Silver asked.
"With respect, Mr. Silver, this is a man you wait on, not a man who waits on you."
Silver's face grimaced with anger, but he gave a curt nod and Killian departed through another door from the one Silver had used. Silver had become increasingly intolerant of anyone who challenged his power as he scraped his father's old guard from the top of the organization. Silver rankers were not to be trifled with, however. There were rumors that one of his guests had been dealing with Clarissa Ventress and had ultimately been the object of her demise. Silver crashed into one of the soft armchairs, gesturing for his bodyguard to fix him a drink. The drinks cabinet was one of the few things in the room that had remained from his father's tenure.
"Bring the bottle, then wait outside."
By the time Killian returned, he was three drinks in, the spirits fueling the perpetually burning furnace of rage and resentment inside him. The man Killian returned with was fully obscured under a robe. Silver's aura sensors stopped dead when they met it, suggesting silver rank concealment magic.
"I usually like to know who I'm dealing with," Silver said.
"Our guest is a man who greatly values his anonymity," Killian said.
"You may call me Mr. Sparrow," the hooded figure said. There was a slight reverb to his voice, indicating voice-disguising magic. "You have my thanks for the accommodations you have made. The arrangements have been very satisfactory."
"Please sit," Killian said,
although he remained standing as Silver and Mr. Sparrow sat down.
"I understand you are looking to have someone taken quickly and quietly," Mr. Sparrow said.
"That's right," Silver said. "I want him placed in my possession, but it must be done in utmost secrecy. He's known to be slippery, resourceful, and elusive, so I need someone who can strike quickly and definitively. I am told this is an area of specialty for you."
"It is," Sparrow said. "Utmost secrecy is my preferred method of conducting my affairs, so I believe we should be able to reach a mutually satisfactory arrangement. Who is the person you want taken?"
"An iron rank adventurer," Silver said. "Jason Asano."
Sparrow sat up straight in his chair.
"I've heard of this Asano. You make a difficult request. He has powerful friends that will come looking for him."
"They won't find him," Killian said with confidence. "We have established a secure and isolated location, and Asano himself has an ability that prevents him from being tracked. So long as he is taken cleanly, then he cannot be traced using his Adventure Society badge."
"That's an easy claim to make," Sparrow said, "but harder to verify. I have no interest in being hunted down by gold rankers because your information was bad."
Killian looked to Silver, who nodded.
"We have another guest who can allay your suspicions," Killian said. "I shall go bring him in."
"I'm not accustomed to waiting on others," Sparrow said, a twang of annoyance getting through the voice masking magic.
"My apologies, sir," Killian said. "But for this man, you do."
Silver smirked at Sparrow, being told the same thing he had been earlier. Killian left the room, and Silver poured himself another drink, not bothering to offer one to Sparrow. The pair sat in silence, Sparrow seemingly impassive under the dark hood, as Silver stewed in the feeling of not being the most powerful man in the room. That feeling reminded Silver unpleasantly of the time before his father died. His father's chief people would look at him with disrespect, spreading rumors that the old man would not pass the mantle to his son. Sophie Wexler was meant to have been the symbol of him seizing power, the woman his father had always shielded from him, finally in his grasp. Instead, she had become a symbol of his impotence, flaunting herself in front of her new high society friends. Her Adventure Society membership had placed her truly out of his reach. If an adventurer went looking for trouble in the criminal underworld and found a knife in his gut, the Adventure Society would pass it off as self-inflicted damage. If the criminal underworld went looking for adventurers, though, the Adventure Society would crash down on them like a tsunami. It meant that even if they used, killed, and dumped Wexler's body quickly, there would be too many threads leading back to him. Instead, he would have to make do with Asano, the man who had intervened to deny her to anyone. The inability to track Asano gave them an opportunity that they would not have with other adventurers. It was still dangerous, which is why he had been hesitant when his second guest had suggested it. That guest was being led into the room by an obsequious Killian, Silver and Sparrow, both rising from their seats at the new arrival.
"Lucian Lamprey," Sparrow said,
his modulator failing to hide the surprise in his voice.
Lamprey looked at the hooded figure, and a smirk crossed his face.
"Hello, Lawrence," Lamprey said. "Do say hello to your sister for me."
Sparrow flinched, but didn't respond to Lamprey's jibe.
"What's your interest in this?" Sparrow asked instead. "The boy has aggravated me," Lamprey said. "Anyone with eyes can see that he's the kind of vermin you need to squash before it grows too large to deal with."
Sparrow turned to Silver.
"What do you need me for if you already have a silver anchor?" Sparrow asked.
"Because when Asano vanishes and is never seen again, it won't be too long before someone asks me where I was at the time. I'm going to make sure I'm visible enough that I can round up people like cattle to give me an alibi. Also, he has some kind of communication power. I can take him down, but not before he gets word out. We need someone who can take him down clean before he knows what hit him. That's your specialty."
"You're certain he can't be traced?"
"Completely," Lamprey said.
"The problem with these low rankers with the power to avoid tracking is that any kind of magic strong enough to punch through it burns out the aura imprint it's trying to track. By the time they get strong enough for the powers to work, the little pricks are strong enough that then their power shields them from it. The Magic Society has been trying to solve the problem for years, so they can track Adventure Society badges better. That same annoyance, though, gives us an opportunity to take Asano that we wouldn't have with another adventurer. Otherwise, we'd take the girl."
"You seem confident," Sparrow said.
"Yes," Lamprey said.
"You don't have to worry about anyone finding anything at the scene. Even if you're sloppy enough that people find out where you took him from, the Magic Society won't find anything useful. I'll see to that."
Sparrow started pacing back and forth.
"If I'm going to do this," he said, "Asano can never see the light of day again. He has to be dead and buried."
"Forget buried," Silver said gleefully. "He's going to be dead and scattered across the delta in tiny pieces for wildlife to eat. Eventually, anyway, once there isn't enough flesh left on him to feel pain."
"You are going to do this," Lamprey told Sparrow. "You knew that from the moment you saw me walk through the door, Lawrence. All that's left is to haggle the price."
"The price has been paid to my satisfaction," Sparrow said.
"And what is Silver paying you?" Lamprey asked.
"Actually, don't tell me. Your predilections are appalling even to me, and that's saying something."
"Asano is already overdue to return to the city," Killian said. "He could be back at any time now."
"He was caught up in a Silver Rank manifestation," Lamprey said.
"Another one," Killian said, frowning. "If the monster surge is starting, that will complicate the site we've set up to hold Asano in."
"It isn't the monster surge," Lamprey said. "These manifestations are just precursor signs. It could be months before the surge hits in full force."
"Then we act?" Silver asked.
"Yes," Lamprey said.
"Then I will need details," Sparrow said. "Everything you have on Asano, and where you want me to bring him."
Killian gave an unctuous smile.
"I have everything you need."
Pantero's Bakery in the Cavendish district of Old City was always busy. For Jason, however, both a regular customer and a young adventurer on the rise, service always came quick.
"You bought a lot today, Mr. Asano?"
"My team just got back into town, Mrs. Pantero.
We're having a bit of a celebration."
"How long does it take to visit a bakery?"
Sophie complained, then shook her head.
"Look who I'm talking about. I once saw him go through half a cart of apples looking for the perfect ones for a pie. They're pie apples. They don't have to be that good."
The team was lounging on the deck of the Cloud houseboat, returned to its spot at the marina in Greenstone. Jory had joined them. He had spotted them passing the clinic just as he was closing up for the day. He was now nestled next to Belinda, the pair sharing a large cloud chair.
"He is taking a while," Henrietta agreed.
"I bet he spotted some new food in the window of a shop," Jory said. "I've learned better than to walk down certain streets with him. If he sees something new to eat, you're lucky if he just buys it instead of finding his way to the kitchen."
"Oh, gods, yes," Clive said with a laugh. "I showed him this dumpling soup place once. You know the one, Humphrey, and Jason got a job there for about a week. Jory, you're lucky he hasn't suborned your alchemy lab for some grand cooking experiment."
"Has the Alchemy Association been hounding you about the miracle potion recipe?" Neil asked him. On their return, Jory had gifted the team with the first batch of lesser miracle potions his alchemy facility produced. It was a thank you for Jason giving him the funding to build the facility in the first place. "They've been restricting themselves to fairly blatant hints that they'd like the formula," Jory said. "Now that I have the Church of the Healer backing me, they aren't pushing. I suspect if the healer hadn't made the clinic sanctified ground, they would have broken in to steal it by now." Suddenly the whole team went deathly still.
"What is it?" Jory asked.
"Party leader Jason Asano has had his magical abilities suppressed. Ability, party interface, has been negated. Your party has been disbanded."
Chapter 17. The Man Behind the Mouth. The room was almost entirely bare of features, a dark stone box with no windows. There was a heavy steel door, a recessed glowstone in the ceiling, and a metal chain staked into the hard floor. The other end of the chain was affixed to a power suppression collar around the neck of a naked body. Jason was chained up and unconscious, lying on the hard stone. On the other side of the door were Killian Laurent and the cloaked figure of Mr. Sparrow. They stood in another stone room, although this one was largely stacked with crates.
"You are confident you got away clean?" Killian asked.
"Short of a gold ranker specialized in stealth and tracking having followed, then yes."
"You have our gratitude, Mr. Sparrow," Killian said. "You will find your usual arrangements waiting at the usual place. But I have also arranged a little bonus I am confident you will find tantalizing."
"Then my part in this is done, and I wash my hands of it," Sparrow said. "You would be well advised not to bring this matter up again, Laurent. You would be even better advised to make sure no one else brings up my participation in it."
"I shall keep your advice in mind," Killian said. "I believe you know that my discretion can be relied upon, Mr. Sparrow."
Sparrow's hooded head nodded. Then he stepped into a shadow and disappeared. With Sparrow gone, Laurent left the room. The building was nothing more than those two rooms, located right where the delta met the desert. It had once been one of the way stations the Magic Society used to transfer spirit coin shipments from the farms. Disused for a number of years, the small outpost was both secure and isolated. It had been abandoned decades ago as more coin farms went into operation, changing the transport routes and requiring larger facilities. It had a paved area where shipments were transferred, the once level pavers now shifted and uneven. There was a second, smaller building that had been the security station, with large reflective windows. The alchemically treated glass both helped keep the interior cool and prevented those outside from seeing in. Inside the security building were three people, including another of the precious few bronze rankers in Silver's organization. Silver was intent on keeping the location secure and had hand-picked the three to manage the site. The bronze ranker came out to meet Killian.
"Mr. Laurent," the man said respectfully.
Of the bronze rankers under Silver, Killian was the unquestionable leader.
"Thank you for refreshing the cooling magic on the security building."
"Of course, Remy," Killian said. "Mr. Silver puts a great deal of value and trust in you. How are your people?"
"Coburn is solid, not what you'd call a deep thinker, but he knows when to keep his ears open and mouth shut. The other one, Jeddak, has some real potential. I've worked with him before. I was surprised to see him selected for this, though. He's only been in the organization a few months.
Mr. Silver prefers the newer people he recruited himself after clearing out his father's old mainstays, Killian said. Those who have taken pains to demonstrate their loyalty are his most valued people. Otherwise, he prefers the people he has recruited and cultivated himself. It avoids any issues with nostalgic loyalties.
Remy nodded. The old man had too many scruples, leaving money on the table all over. Mr. Silver isn't caught up in old ways of thinking.
Just so, Killian said. Jeddak has a history with our guest. Asano is responsible for his being struck off the Adventure Society rolls, as well as ruining the man's relationship with the nobleman he was working for.
Remy frowned. I don't like personal connections. It stops people from doing their job properly.
I'm not unsympathetic, Remy, but Mr. Silver felt that Jeddak would share his passion for seeing that Asano gets what is coming to him.
He's the boss, Remy said. If he wants it, he gets it.
Killian smiled with his thin, pale lips.
That's an attitude that will take you far, Remy. I'm leaving now to bring Mr. Silver. Remember that we want to maintain the illusion of this location's abandonment.
We'll stay in the building and out of sight.
Check on our guest every hour, Killian said. Once he's awake, give him a spirit coin to eat. Mr. Silver wants him strong and healthy enough to survive what we have planned.
The ache in Jason's body as he regained consciousness paled in comparison to the pain digging into his brain like a railroad spike. It was an unpleasantly nostalgic feeling, taking him back to his first hours in this world when he had been knocked out multiple times in quick succession. Only a few potions and a dose of healing magic staved off a lethal brain hemorrhage at the time. His first thought was to open his inventory and grab a potion, but his inventory window appeared only in a haze of static before blinking out again. He tried to bring up other interface windows, but received the same result. Muscles protesting, he pushed himself to a sitting position and fumbled at his neck, finding a thick iron choker. He had never worn a suppression collar, but had used them on others. It was obvious that this was the source of his power problem. He could still feel Colin inside his blood, but the connection to him that Jason normally experienced seemed strangely obstructed. He could tell that trying to bring out his familiar wouldn't work, and the attempt might have a painful backlash. On the bright side, Colin's power to heal him was still in effect. He could already feel the aches in his body clearing up and the fuzziness in his head fading away. Jason took stock of his situation. His clothes were gone, although most of his adventuring gear was safely stashed in his inventory. The only important item missing was his new amulet. He sat cross-legged as he looked around. He was in a room of desert stone. It was warm rather than cold, not too unpleasant to sit on. The sun-warmed brick meant that he probably wasn't underground, despite the lack of windows. The chain linking him to the floor wasn't long enough for him to stand, only sit or kneel. Even leaning too far forward caused it to tug at his neck in a choking grip. The rest of the room had little to offer, just a heavy metal door and a glowstone in the ceiling. Jason had no idea who had come after him, remembering nothing but a dark shape erupting out of an alley. It may have been a bronze ranker, although a silver was more likely. He had a high enough opinion of his own powers to think that even a bronze ranker would have trouble so thoroughly blindsiding him with darkness and stealth. His circumstances weren't great, but not completely hopeless either. If whoever had taken him wanted him dead, then he already would be. He didn't expect his near future to be pleasant, however. Colin's healing power would likely be very useful.
If you can hear me in there, Colin, stop the healing until I say so. If they don't know you can still help me, you can be my secret weapon for what comes next.
Although the connection was dimmed, Jason got a sense of assent from his familiar. With no other options, Jason sat and meditated. A while later, Jason sensed the approach of a bronze rank aura, meaning at least his aura sensors remained intact. The person came into the room, and Jason opened his eyes.
"You've got a henchman look about you," Jason said. "I don't suppose I could seduce you and secretly pocket the keys to this collar?"
"Well, I say pocket." He indicated his naked body. "It's a figure of speech, obviously." The stony-faced man tossed a spirit coin at Jason, who caught it out of the air.
"Eat. The boss wants you healthy for what he's got planned."
"I'm guessing it's not a charity fun run. So, who's the boss? If Tony Danza walks in here, I'm going to lose it." The man gave a confused frown and left without answering. Jason wondered how long he would be able to keep up the banter before whatever was coming took its toll. He examined the coin, but his interface again gave a fuzz of static and vanished without giving him any information. It seemed like an ordinary spirit coin. The crystalline object was a dull iron colour. It seemed unlikely to be some kind of trap. In his current situation, they didn't need subterfuge to make him ingest poison or some tainted object. Keeping his strength up was an obviously good idea, but he ultimately tossed the coin into the corner. In his studies of magic, Jason had learned there were certain kinds of magic, usually involving the soul, that required willing participation. Without it, the soul was largely inviolable, even to the most potent magical forces. He wasn't willing to take the chance that eating the coin was the acceptance of some magical end-user license agreement. It was some time before the door opened again to admit two people. One was dressed in the kind of expensive style that made sure everyone knew how much their clothes cost. The cut seemed familiar, and Jason suspected the man used the same tailor as Thadwick Mercer. The man in the fancy clothes looked young. That was hardly an achievement given the bronze rank aura, but there was also an immaturity to his snide expression. Jason had known enough high rankers to recognize a level of easy confidence and equanimity in those whose youthful face belied their age. This man had the bearing of a boy. The boy man's aura, in addition to his looks, marked him as mediocre. Jason's perception power wouldn't enhance his aura senses until it ranked up a second time, but he could almost smell the monster cores the man had used, as if he'd drenched himself in some nasty cologne. Jason doubted the man had ever faced a monster in the wild. Next to the human was a startlingly creepy elf, whose dark clothes made his sickly pallid skin stand out all the more. Jason suspected the man to have been altered by his essence powers. The kinds of powers that fundamentally changed a person were the kind that usually landed their original essences on the restricted list. Jason would have not been at all surprised to find the death essence in the man's repertoire.
"So," the boy man said, "you're the Jason Asano that's been causing such a ruckus."
"If I said you had the wrong guy, I don't suppose you'd let me go?"
Jason was still sitting cross-legged on the floor. The chain would not allow him to take his feet and face his captors.
"You have no idea how bad the rest of your short life is going to be," the boy man said. "Do you even know who I am?"
"You're definitely not Tony Danza," Jason said. "If you're Judith Light, life has taken you down some very odd roads."
"What are you babbling about?" the boy man asked.
"He's spouting nonsense to put you off," the elf said, in a voice as creepy as the rest of him. "Don't let him distract you."
"So you're the Palpatine to his Vader," Jason said to the elf. "I know the routine. Just to save you some time, giving in to my hatred will be an easy sell under the circumstances."
"Shut up," the boy man yelled. "My name is Cole Silver."
"You're Cole Silver?" Jason asked.
"That's right," Silver said, gloatingly. "Now you understand what kind of trouble you're in."
"The name doesn't ring a bell," Jason said, brow creasing as he strained to recall.
"Wait, did you sell me that dodgy magic food processor? The pulse setting on that thing was rubbish.
Is this revenge for complaining to the Artifice Association about your shoddy standards?
I think we both know that's really on you." "I'm one of the big three," Silver yelled.
Jason suppressed a grin at the elf's reaction. He clearly wanted to interject, but was unwilling to risk the younger man's temper.
"Oh, the crime lords," Jason said, realization dawning in his voice.
I've met Adrus Dorgan, very cool guy. He has that combination of class and masculinity that lets him really carry off that dapper look. Then there's Clarissa Ventress, and that other one? I forget the name because everyone just calls him the stupid one. I have to say, Clarissa, you don't look anything like how you were described. Silver lunged at Jason, but bone spears erupted from the hard brick floor like a wall to block him off. Silver turned his furious glare on the elf.
Mr. Silver, the elf said. Don't let him goad you into giving him a quick death. Nothing you can do will be worse than what we already have in store for him.
Silver fumed, but enough of the rage drained away that he got himself back under control. Silver angrily tugged his clothes back into place as the bone spears disappeared, leaving holes in the stone floor. He then turned a malevolent grin on Jason.
We'll see if you're still so clever once the pain begins,
Silver told Jason. I will be, Jason said. It just won't show because of the screaming and begging. I'm pretty sure they'll be begging. I don't know what you want from me exactly, but I hope it's not dignity. You took my pants, though, so I'm guessing that's not an issue?
All I want is for you to pay for the things you've taken from me, Silver said.
Which didn't include fashion advice, thankfully, Jason said.
You need to tone it down,
which is really saying something with the way people dress in Greenstone.
It will be interesting to see how long your courage holds, the elf said.
Oh, that's long gone, Jason said.
This is pretty much terrified babble I'm trying to pass off as bravado. The inability to wet myself is the only thing selling it at this point.
The elf gave Jason a hungry smile. Silver snorted derision.
You willingly admit to fear.
I'm chained up, naked, in a room with the winner of the most obvious sex predator contest, and the guy got disqualified for being too creepy. Not being scared is admitting to being an idiot.
Mr. Silver, I think it's time to show him.
Will he even know what it is?
Silver asked.
I didn't tell you, the elf said. Our friend here is the one who procured it in the first place.
Really? Silver said, with a sinister chuckle. That's almost poetry.
A bone cabinet rose up out of the floor, reminding Jason of the stone chest storage space that Farrah had. This also proved to be a storage space, as the elf took out an object Jason recognized. It was held in a cubic metal frame, a sphere made up entirely of tiny little bricks the colour of grey stone.
Starseed, Jason said, his face turning pale. You're with the Builder Cult.
Not at all, the elf said. This is the very same star seed that you acquired and was taken by the Church of Purity. When the temple's assets were being seized, we managed to snag this little treasure. And now we are going to return it to you.
Jason said nothing, fierce eyes locked on the elf.
There he is, the elf said with delight. The man behind the mouth.
You'd best be very careful about what happens next, Jason said, or you might come to regret having met him.
Chapter 18. Search. Killian began the elaborate preparations to use the starseed. He started by conjuring up skeletal arms that he used to hammer a spike into the ceiling, which he then hung a pair of manacles from. He unlatched the chain from Jason's suppression collar, and then used the skeleton arms to force Jason's wrists into the manacles. Jason didn't bother to struggle, saving his strength. Once Jason was hanging uncomfortably from the ceiling, Killian took a series of pouches from his bone storage cabinet, pouring powder from them to make a complex ritual circle under Jason's feet. When that was done, he started placing objects into the circle. Some were simple bricks of precious materials, others were tools made from exotic metals.
How exactly do you know how to do all this? Jason asked.
That's actually a good question, Silver said, watching from the side. How did you learn a builder cult ritual?
From a builder cultist. Obviously, Killian said. You opened your operations to people your father would never deal with, and the Builder cult seized the opportunity. When Thalia Mercer started kicking down doors, why do you think so many of them were yours?
You facilitated this,
Silver asked.
Your exact words were, more money, less questions,
Killian said.
He's put you in bed with the enemy of the whole world, Jason said.
Do you even know what the Builder cult is doing? They're plundering whole chunks of this world like dimensional pirates, and they don't care who or what is destroyed in the process. That's not an association you can run far enough to escape, Silver.
Shut up, Silver snarled.
What's done is done, Killian said calmly. The only way forward is forward.
Killian placed the final object, the starseed, directly underneath Jason.
And now we begin, he said.
Thalia met Clive and Neil in one of the Mercer family's receiving parlors.
Neil, Thalia Mercer greeted. Always a pleasure. And Mr. Standish, hello again. You'll have to accept my apology, but I can only spare a little time. The Builder cult has gone underground, which has made rooting them out all the more work.
Then we'll go directly to the point, Neil said. Jason Asano has gone missing. Thalia frowned.
You're sure it's foul play? I recall he went off without telling anyone once before, during the time he was seeing Cassandra.
We're sure, Neil said.
I'm not sure exactly how I can help, Thalia said.
We're looking into anyone with the motivation to do something to Jason, Clive said. You're the spearhead of the Builder cult investigation now.
You think the Builder cult might be behind it? Thalia asked. Revenge for taking a star seed from them. It seems like they would have larger concerns.
Clive and Neil both took on awkward expressions.
That's true, Lady Mercer, Clive said. We were thinking of another potential scenario. To be blunt, we're talking about Thadwick.
Thalia's expression went dark.
Thadwick is a prisoner. A victim.
Most likely, yes, Neil said. We're simply exploring every possibility, however remote.
We don't understand how much the original personality survives once a star seed takes over, Clive said. It may well be that Thadwick's own personality is suppressed, but the thing that's taken him over inherited his hatred of Jason and is acting on it.
We both know that Thadwick had become fixated on Jason, Neil said to Thalia. Jason had become the symbol of his recent setbacks.
Even if what you're saying were true, Thalia said, what could I do that I haven't already done? You think I haven't been trying to get my son back? He's been gone for months now. For all we know, he was in the pile of corpses that Remor and his parents left on that island. They're still sorting through the bodies, trying to identify them all.
The thing is, Neil said, we've all been operating under the assumption that Thadwick has been wholly supplanted by the Starseed.
If he is more of a gestalt entity, Clive picked up, then that may open avenues of investigation that you otherwise may have overlooked. Places that Thadwick would think to go.
I may be emotionally invested in my son's return, Thalia said, but I'm not blinded by emotion. From the point we realized the cult was acting on Thadwick's knowledge, we immediately tried every avenue we could think of that might be driven by his thinking instead of the cult.
She got to her feet.
That is all the time I have to spare,
she said, her voice cold and dismissive.
You know the way out, Neil.
Mr. Remor, Dorgan greeted. Of course you are welcome in my home, but I didn't realize we were meeting this openly.
Do you know why I'm here? Rufus asked.
The absentee Mr. Asano, I can only assume, Dorgan said. My understanding is that he's been known to go off without notice before.
This isn't that, Rufus said.
Well, let me begin by asserting that I am neither responsible nor complicit.
Do you know who is?
I only met Mr. Asano the one time,
Dawkins said. He struck me as someone who likes to play games above his rank, with a rather insufferable smugness. Frankly, I'm surprised it took this long for him to mysteriously disappear. I need answers, not more questions. Well, while there are any number of candidates, there are not so many stupid enough to risk the wrath of you and your friends. Or your parents. Good gods. No sane person would cross a pair of gold rankers. Who would? Coalsilver? Probably. Poor judgment, fierce temper. I've known him since he was a boy. The girl, too. She may be the only thing he was ever truly denied. I think you've deeply underestimated just how angry Cole is over being frustrated in the moment he thought he finally had her. Ventress understood the depths of that feeling and used it as a weapon. You think Silver is responsible? All I have for you is conjecture, based on my understanding of Cole. He's arrogant enough, but I'm not sure he would make the attempt without prompting. Even if he's responsible, you may want to look elsewhere for the origin of the scheme. Whoever came up with the idea is secondary, Rufus said. Finding Asano is the priority. Well, I don't have him, or know who does. All I can offer is some advice. If you look into Silver, don't look to Silver himself. Look for what he's been doing. Even if he isn't fool enough to take your friend without precautions, find those precautions and you find your friend, presuming Silver is the one that took him. Danielle and Humphrey Geller had come upon Lucian Lamprey as he was reading in the Magic Society library. He was in an open area full of comfortable reading chairs and didn't bother to get up from the one he was occupying. He put his book down on a side table and convivially waved at them to join him.
You are very easy to find, Mr. Lamprey,
Danielle said, sitting down. Humphrey remained standing, next to her chair.
To the point of conspicuousness, in fact. One might almost think you were being fastidious about establishing an alibi.
And for exactly what dark deeds would I need an alibi, Lady Geller?
Jason Asano has gone missing.
Oh, I suppose I can see why you would look at me. But I have to imagine I am but a single name on a very long list. He might have made allies out of powerful people like yourself, but he's annoyed even more, taking opportunities that rightly belonged to Greenstone's nobility. A complete disregard for proprietary decorum and the inherent superiority of the aristocratic class. He's made enemies he's never even met.
But you're the one who threatened him in public,
Danielle said.
That was just talk. I just lost out in court. And you can't deny he has both the ability and intent to get under people's skin. If I genuinely intended to have someone disposed of, then I would make it a point to be friendly rather than threaten them. Even putting aside the warning, it helps avoid conversations like this one.
Danielle gave him a smile that didn't reach her eyes.
I assume we can count on the full support of the Magic Society in finding him.
Naturally, Lamprey said. I'll hand-pick anyone involved in trying to find him and supervise everything personally. Of course, he does have that little issue with tracking, doesn't he? Such a shame.
Danielle stood back up.
Mr. Lamprey, if you did happen across someone involved in this situation, through sheer happenstance, for example, then you would be well served by convincing them to reconsider the whole enterprise.
Oh, I couldn't agree more, Lamprey said. With Bahadir and the Remors, it means dealing with gold rankers. That's something only someone as foolish as Asano would do.
Danielle levied a penetrating gaze on Lamprey, then turned to leave, Humphrey following after. Lamprey called out after them, and they turned around.
Do let me know if a body turns up. It will reopen legal proceedings regarding a young lady in dire need of some strict guidance.
The Adventure Society won't let you touch her, Humphrey said, face creased with anger. And even if they did, I wouldn't.
The yapping of a dog, hiding under its owner's skirts, Lamprey said dismissively. Have you taken a liking to my thief, little doggy?
I'd never let you take her as an indentured servant, Humphrey said. I wouldn't let you take anyone.
No, Lamprey asked. I didn't see you in court last year when I claimed my previous one.
He shook his head sadly.
Poor girl. So pretty. But she went mysteriously missing too. Of course, she didn't have the heroic Geller clan rushing to her rescue. Do you only help poor people when Asano tells you to? I do hope he's all right, or you'll have to go back to protecting heiresses.
Danielle placed a hand on Humphrey's shoulder, silencing the reply he was about to spit out.
You should be careful, Lamprey, she said. Mysterious disappearances seem to be going around.
Are you threatening me, Lady Geller?
Danielle strode back across the room, Lamprey standing up to meet her. The tall, muscular elf towered over the small woman, but she radiated threat like a sword. The clash of their auras drew looks from the few library patrons, not already surreptitiously watching the confrontation between the director of the Magic Society and the city's most famous adventurer. Their auras pushed against one another, until finally Lamprey's yielded under the flawless, unflinching power and control of Danielle's.
Lamprey, if Asano is dead, and I find out you're involved, I'm going to carve you up for chum on the steps of the Adventure Society for everyone to see, and then use you to go shark fishing. That was me threatening you.
Belinda made her way down an alley in Old City, stopping in front of an unmarked door and knocking twice. A panel on the door slid across, revealing a pair of eyes that went wide on recognizing Belinda.
Is she in?
Belinda asked.
You shouldn't be here, the woman behind the door said. There are all kinds of stories going around about you and Wexler.
The reality is crazier than the stories, I promise.
Just go, Belinda.
Belinda projected her aura through the door, suppressing that of the woman behind it.
I'm going through that door, Belinda said. It'll go better for both of us if you open it first.
Let her in,
came another voice from inside. It was the rich, deep voice of an older woman. The door opened, the woman behind it watching Belinda warily as she went past. The older woman had a broad, mannish body and curly hair down to her shoulders. She was in her early 50s, but fit and strong.
Hello, Marge,
Belinda greeted.
Lindy, Marge said warmly. Please, come up.
She led Belinda up some stairs and onto the flat roof, where picnic furniture had been set up on a rug. Marge waved Belinda to a chair, taking another for herself.
You know, Lindy, we really have been hearing some strange stories. I even heard you were an adventurer now.
Not yet, Belinda said. Sophie is. I have the essences, but put off the field assessment while we went on a monster safari.
You have essences.
Belinda shapeshifted, becoming a duplicate of Marge.
Now that's something we could get some use out of, Marge said. I don't suppose I can talk you into taking a job.
Sorry, Marge. It's the straight and narrow for me.
That's a shame. What brings you here, then?
A man has gone missing. Sophie and I are looking into whether one of the big three are behind it.
You think they are?
It's possible. He's annoyed them all in one way or another, largely in the process of helping me and Sophie. So we owe him.
Jason Asano, Marge said.
You've heard of him?
His name started floating around when he was working at the Broad Street Clinic. I hear you've been spending some time there yourself.
Belinda blushed.
Can you find out about Asano for me?
I can ask around, Marge said.
How urgent.